Hi everyone, just a quick message to let you know that this episode was recorded before the COVID pandemic. As we're all learning and growing, some views may have shifted in the meantime, and this episode doesn't necessarily reflect current events. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hello everyone, this is For Art's Sake, the podcast giving voice to museum people. We are here to uncover their untold stories, for art's sake and for your sake.
We are joined this week by Holly Wilson, the Programme Manager for the Wolfson Project at the British Museum. In her work, Holly is dedicated to creating inclusive and accessible museum experiences for children and adults alike. She has previously worked with charities, the corporate world, and even medical technology.
We're really looking forward to hearing all about Holly's current work and how she got to where she is today. So, Holly, welcome, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Holly, before we get into your current work, your background is kind of really interesting. Correct me if I'm wrong, before you were involved in charities and museums and corporate stuff, you studied biotechnology and bioengineering. How did that career change happen?
Yeah, it's quite a big career change. So growing up, I liked maths and physics, and I also liked helping people. So I did a lot of volunteering. And when I saw bioengineering, I thought it was a great way to combine all of those together. So I did bioengineering, did a lot around biomechanics, prosthetics, that sort of thing. So assistive device technology, which is how it fitted into my volunteering with disabled people. But then when I was in my third year, I did an internship at PwC and ended up being offered a full-time role there. So decided to do that. Wanted to get some corporate experience. Did that for 2.5 years. Got to travel around the world with that. So that was really interesting, seeing different sectors, working quite a lot in the health and medical device technology sector. But then just realised it wasn't for me. Realised that I liked being a project manager, but actually the stuff that I'd done originally around helping people and working with disabled people, it was actually the area that I felt more comfortable in and was more passionate about. So actually decided to make quite the big and brave career move, I think, to go back into sort of charity and third sector work. Started at MenCap, so Barnet MenCap, working sort of more on the other side to what I do now. So planning trips, supporting people more of a one-to-one basis. So I'd actually be the person organising trips into the museums or into the arts institution for my group. And through that, had really seen the barriers that were there and actually that it can be quite a difficult experience for some people and quite overwhelming. And so when I saw the opportunity at the British Museum to be doing something that actually would make the museum more accessible for lots of people and support and help lots of people, I decided to make the move across. So quite diverse background.
Yeah, definitely.
That's wonderful. Like, you get to see a bit of both and you finally got into the Wolfson Project now?
Yep.
What is that about? How do you get into it? Can you please
what
tell us what it is?
Reason it's called the Wolfson Project is because it's sponsored by the Lord Leonard and Lady Estelle Wolfson Foundation. Mm. So they actually sponsor other organisations, other museums in London and across the country to do similar types of work. So they've got a really big focus on education and access. So it's an education access programme. It's been running since 2014, but fundamentally it's about trying to make the museum more accessible and inclusive for visitors with learning disabilities and other neurodiverse profiles such as autism. So that could be in terms of programming events, it could be resources for independent visits and just general advice and guidance, really.
When did this start, the British Museum, the Wolfson Project?
So my understanding is it started back in 2014.
Right.
And it had a slightly different focus then. This current round has been since 2017, which when it's predominantly had the focus for learning disabilities and autistic visitors. And we're actually going to be starting a third phase starting from April this year, which again will continue the work we've been doing over the last 3 years and expand it into adult programming too.
So it's been changing. How is the project itself different from other inclusivity projects that are happening?
So there'd been quite a lot of focus beforehand on schools and young audiences. So I think you had my colleague, Ed Lawless. Mm-hmm. So he works with the Samsung
Digital
Discovery Centre. There we go. I was like, the SDDC, what does that sound for? And also there's a lot of work being done in our learning team. So in the schools and young audiences team around schools that were coming with students with access requirements, but there hadn't actually been that much work done for independent visits and family visits. So I think that's where it's differed slightly. And actually my role is more about bringing all the separate pieces of work together and embedding it into the regular programming. Mm-hmm. So sort of helping to come up with new ideas, but making sure that it's sustainable going forwards.
So can you elaborate a little bit more on what your role is? What's a typical day in the life of Holly Wilson?
Okay, so sometimes I'll be involved in equality and diversity training. So actually training up staff around different access requirements. So that could be right from security. So we try and, like, my role is to think about the whole journey and not just once they get to the museum. So, you know, somebody could have already had quite a stressful journey. It could have been quite overwhelming for them to even get to the museum in the first place. Mm-hmm. So my role is to think about what happens when they first come, the security staff, how they get through, like, the security tents, etc. So the accessibility actually getting into the museum. Then it'll also be looking at, like I said, events. So doing things like the early mornings. So sort of thinking about what events I've got coming up, making sure that everything's in place for that. And then also a lot of work's done on our resources. So actually, like, our digital online resources. So for instance, today I've been spending the morning trying to arrange for a pre-visit guide to be made, which will actually give a lot of the accessibility information in much more detail in one downloadable guide with lots of photos. So it's really visual, so people can, again, sort of know the barriers and know how to get to the museum and really plan ahead so they know what to expect.
So we wanted to know how you make this information available. If someone wanted to know about this, how do they find out about the project and all the accessibility resources?
So we've been doing quite a lot of work updating the website. So the British Museum got updated just before Christmas, the website. And myself and my manager have been doing a lot of work around that and making sure the accessibility information was updated. As part of that, like I said, we've been doing a lot of online resources. So the sensory map that's now on there, this pre-visit guide, which will go up. So trying to get everything or as much as possible that we can do sort of online, easily accessible and easily visual. And then people can also contact myself and my manager through the access email or the access phone number. So we're available 9 to 5, usually Monday to Friday. And then I do a lot of work in setting up sort of independent visits or group visits and working with them to sort of tailor their visits as they come.
Cool. Are there any highlights from your work with the Wolfson Project so far that, you know, stuff that you're really proud of?
So many. No. So setting up the early mornings has been really fantastic. So that's been done through an advisory panel, so actually working with families directly on sort of trialing stuff, getting lots of feedback. And so we ran our first one back in September and we've got our next one in February. So we did a piece of work looking at the museum from the point of view of sensory processing requirements, so different light levels, noises, crowdy and busy spaces or quieter spaces, and things like temperature and strong smells. And so that's actually useful, not just for visitors with sensory processing requirements, but actually I think it's useful for anybody coming to the museum because it can be overwhelming for anybody coming in. And so I think that's the main thing that I think about all this type of work is obviously I'm designing it for one specific audience in mind, but actually the idea is it should make the museum a more inclusive and accessible place for everybody.
Yeah, which is the idea, and it's a lovely idea. And as you say, everyone can benefit from it, which is something really important to highlight, the fact that it's not only for that target audience, but the fact that making it accessible to a small group of people makes it accessible to everyone.
Yeah, exactly.
So on that note, what do you understand by inclusivity and why is it important in the museum?
I think for me, it goes back to the social model. So I don't know if you've heard the social model, but the idea that somebody, you know, we use the phrase disabled people because actually it's society and the way the society is set up that is disabling that person. It's not that medical version of the impairment causing someone to be disabled. So for me, I suppose, particularly with my background, inclusivity for me is that everybody should feel that they are able to come to the museum or to a space and enjoy it, but also be represented by it too. So it's not just that they're hearing someone else's story, that they're also part of the story too. And so any work that I can do, both within the museum but across the sector to help that, is something I'm really passionate about and really keen to push forward.
Are there any upcoming bits and pieces that you know, can maybe give us a little sneak peek of things that the Wolfson Project or other aspects of inclusivity in the museum are working on to that end of making it a sort of more inclusive space for everybody?
Yeah, like I said, there's been quite a lot of focus in the last 9 months on setting up the early morning. So that's a lot around families and younger audience members. We're doing a lot of work now to increase what we're offering for our adults. So I'm actually working on a project with Action Space.
Okay.
Action Space, yeah. So I'm working with Action Space on a series of workshops, which will bring in disabled artists to actually lead sessions for other disabled visitors. And each one will be focused around a different gallery or collection or free exhibition that we're doing. So that's sort of hot off the press, something that we're setting up at the moment. And we're hoping to run every other month between now and Christmas.
Oh, that's fantastic. And again, it's that inclusivity for everybody. It's that not just token, almost like a tokenistic approach,
yeah,
of, hey, we did a thing about disabled people, but actually including them, that nothing about us without us approach, I think is really important. For anybody who's listening who's maybe not aware, could you explain a little bit about what Action Space is?
Yeah, so Action Space is an organisation. They're actually based really close to the museum in Holborn, and they work with emerging and existing artists or established artists, learning disabilities, on projects, exhibitions, workshops. So quite recently they did the Tate Exchange, so they actually did an interactive where different artists had their artwork displayed and visitors could go in and interact and add to the artwork. So we've worked with them before. They actually came and did Purple Light Up Festival at the museum, but it really is about sort of being disability led and promoting disability arts.
So is there any other initiatives that you know about that are taking place that you would like to highlight or kind of
across
talk about?
The museum sector?
Yeah, anything that you find interesting that you think?
I think just generally, like, we're obviously working on adult programming in terms of accessibility, but also I know speaking to colleagues across the sector, this is something to watch out in a lot of the museums and art galleries coming up. It's something that all of us are pretty much working on and sharing best practice around. So I think it's quite exciting. I think even myself, having only been at the British Museum just under a year now, I've seen a massive change in the sector in terms of the amount that's being offered. And I know a lot of the time autism gets a focus, but I think neurodiversity and other sensory processing requirements are also important to remember. And I think actually over the next year, we're going to see a lot more and a lot more different approaches being taken and things like technology being included. So actually, I think it's a really exciting space to be working in at the moment.
Do you think there's sort of a crossover where the work that's being done in museums, in heritage, in the arts, can carry over to other areas to help improve inclusivity?
Yeah, so actually a couple of weeks ago, I had a meeting with someone from the Business Disability Forum.
Okay.
So they'd actually seen my sensory map from the British Museum, and they're really interested to see how their clients can do something similar to help improve diversity in their workforce. So actually, yeah, they work with places like EY and other consultancies and other professional services firms. And they're thinking, or they're talking to their clients actually about maybe designing something like a sensory map, but actually for an office space.
Right.
And looking at other ways that, you know, we do a lot like volunteer placements and we look at inclusive interview processes and things like that. And actually, therefore, I think there's a lot that's happening in the arts and heritage sector because we're so visible and because we have so many visitors. But actually, it'll be interesting to see how it could be applied internally from an employee point of view. So we're working on that together at the moment. So I hope that'll be something, again, quite interesting that'll come out from the work that the Wolfson Project's been doing.
Brilliant. Sounds really, really good. Really positive. So as a museum professional with a focus on inclusion and diversity and accessibility, what do you want to see more of from museums? What do you want to see more of that already exists or more of that kind of barely exists?
I think for me, what I would like to see more of eventually, you know, what I'm trying to work on is that it doesn't sit as a separate accessible programming, that eventually all spaces or as much as possible, because obviously you have to think about the constraints of like, a listed old building, but that everywhere is accessible and all events are accessible and inclusive. And it's not something that we have to work as like an add-on or something separate, that actually it all just becomes part of the museum and arts sector. So that would be my ideal state. But obviously, I understand there's challenges to get there before we can get there completely.
Yeah, but it'd be nice if it wasn't a bolt-on, an afterthought.
Yeah, it's an afterthought. I think it's just the fact that a lot of the time it's a separate team and right. A lot of the time things will be advertised as accessible events. So for me, it'd be great if it was just our core programming that, you know, all of our events or all of museum and art sector events had that lens on them anyway.
As a starting point,
the museum separate funding, because obviously a lot of the time these projects are funded by external foundations or grants.
You mentioned previously that a big part of your work obviously is provision for adults and and young adults with learning disabilities, the neurodiverse, people with autism. Why is it so important that there is a focus on adults as well?
I think a lot of the time people focus on families and children. And, you know, I've even had the feedback on Twitter and various other, through other feedback channels, you know, autistic children grow up to be autistic adults and why are you not focusing on it? And I think sometimes it can be overlooked. And maybe because people have been doing similar things, there is already an existing model that we know works, and it can be easier to contact organisations and work with established charities or nonprofits and set these things up. And actually, sometimes it can be harder to reach that audience and get engagement, but actually doesn't mean that we shouldn't do it. It just means that we need to push harder to make it happen.
Because as you say, at some point they're going to grow, and it's not only the child, it's the family sometimes, yeah, giving that support to all of them. I guess that's part of the project, isn't it? Like, not only the person with the disability, but also whoever is around them.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, I've had parents contact me to say, actually, it's me that has autism, not my child. But yet the focus has been put on bringing your children with an access requirement. So even just changing wording to be like, actually, our early morning events are for families with sensory processing requirements. Therefore, it fits the adult that has the sensory processing requirement. They can bring their child and they can still enjoy it as a family. And I think that's the thing for me, is even though we do the early morning sessions, really, I just want to make the museum open at a time when anybody can come and enjoy the quiet space. And it's more about being in the space and understanding the stories, less about the activities and having to come and complete a certain number of activities or be involved in a certain way. Just come and be involved in a way that you want to be and that works for you. But yeah, definitely, you know, we've been working with a lot up to sort of 25 children and young people. And now I really want to try and push to focus on that plus 25 age range.
Do you have any kind of numbers on how many adults with learning disabilities do you work with, any kind of numbers?
So, that's quite a difficult question. So when we did the Purple Light Up Festival, that had 600 people engage with it, but we didn't split it by different demographics. So Purple Light Up Festival was a day we ran on the 3rd of December, which corresponded with International Day of Disabled Persons. So it's a day, you know, awareness day across the world. And in the UK, we have a specific thing that's been set up called hashtag Purple Light Up. So it's about celebrating it within the arts and heritage sector. So we did a day of disability-led workshops, performances, tours. So it's about showcasing disabled artists, but also about the accessible offering within the museum. So as part of that, we had 600 people roughly attend and be involved and engaged with it. But unfortunately, we didn't break it down by different sort of ages or disabled versus non-disabled. In terms of more specific, smaller groups, we ran an advisory panel which had 15 adults with learning disabilities that came from different organisations. And they were actually involved directly in co-creating workshops that we ran, relaxed workshops and performances. But really, I'm hoping for going forwards that we can start to mirror the numbers that we're getting for the families event, which is sort of looking at more like 150 to 200 per event. So hopefully we can grow that number vastly over
Fingers crossed.
Few months. Yeah.
Yeah. How much of these events these mornings is them getting in contact with you versus you reaching out to them?
It varies. So for instance, if I go back to Early Morning Explorers, I started an advisory panel, which was for families with autistic children. And that was a lot of me sort of contacting organisations, saying I'm running an advisory panel. Do you have families that would want to be involved? I'd had quite a few very proactive individual inquiries come through to me. So I also had emailed those parents to say, would you like to be a part of it? And to be honest, once I had that core group of about 15, they then use their networks. So there is a very, very well-established network already out there through Facebook and social media and local support groups. And yeah, within the space of about a week of me putting the event out, they'd tweeted it, retweeted it, put it all over Facebook. I think we had 200 tickets go in the first week or something like that. And now, to be honest, it's quite, yeah, I don't have to do much to get those events booked. It's very much you put tweets out, you contact a few organisations and it snowballs, really.
As a visitor, do you have any tips for being mindful of adults with learning disabilities?
Because there's a lot of focus on what museums are doing, but obviously the museums aren't just the staff. There's also everybody else who's visiting the museum who perhaps might not be as considerate as they could be.
I think understanding is a big thing, and also being aware of invisible disabilities. So, you know, a lot of people won't necessarily realise that somebody has a disability or an access requirement. So I think really trying to take a step back before you maybe react to somebody behaving in a slightly different way than you would, or somebody might be looking in distress and, you know, going over and saying, how can I help? But yeah, really, like, no judgment. I think that's one thing I hear a lot from families and from individual visitors and adults, is they like to come knowing, like, at our specific relaxed events, that there's going to be no judgment, that actually everybody is trained and we understand what, you know, what's going on. And I suppose that's my big thing for visitors attending. Don't just jump to conclusions. Take back, step, think, and try and be as unjudgmental as possible.
Which, again, shouldn't only happen within the museum space, but just in general, just in life.
Just general, you know, somebody on the tube asks you for a seat, they've probably got a good reason to ask you for a seat if they've come up to ask you, and that probably will have taken them quite a lot of courage. So don't just
People on the tube aren't nice.
Yeah. So, yeah, but a lot of the time, you know, if someone's come and asked you for a seat, they probably have a very good reason to need it. Mm. So again,
especially in London.
Yeah, assume, don't assume anything.
Obviously, we've said before, autism is a big focus.
Yeah.
Why is it that it is such the focus for so many of the inclusion initiatives? What are the sort of the needs and the requirements that make that such a priority?
So I think it's probably that it was maybe overlooked for so long. Mm. So, you know, there's been quite a lot of established events and programs for deaf visitors. You know, we've had audio descriptive tours, ESL-led tours, and they've been very well established for so long. And actually, with autism or other neurodiverse or sensory processing requirements, it's very different, because actually crowds is a huge factor, lighting can be a huge factor. So you have to actually approach things from quite a different way. You know, you can't easily adapt some of our other, so for instance, we've been doing like highlights tours, and we're working on doing deaf-led BSL versions of the highlights tours. Well, actually, you can still do those during the main times of the day. You can still do them in the gallery spaces when there are other visitors. But actually, you can't easily adapt that for autistic visitors, because some autistic visitors cannot handle being in that space during, you know, a 2 o'clock Wednesday afternoon when it's really busy. So I think that's why it's becoming such a big focus, because actually it is about opening the galleries up at different times, or spaces up at different times, and actually having to put a lot of work and thinking into adapting the environment. And even just things like the resources we use, you know, thinking about colour and design, all that sort of stuff needs to be changed.
This being something so important that we are aware of, why do you think some museums and institutions are not kind of focusing on inclusivity?
I think fundamentally it will come down to resources. So it will come down to staffing, money. You know, we're very lucky that we have this funding from the foundation. So that funds my role, that funds the work that we're doing. But, you know, other organisations I know are working on it, but just on a smaller scale. So usually a lot of the time it will be in people's agenda. They will be aware of it, and it's more just the constraints they have. So I have lots of colleagues from across the sector who contact me and say, you know, hoping to run something or to make changes. We can't do it on the same scale that you're doing it, but can you give us some tips on just smaller things we could do? So I think that's what's really important to remember, that I think it is something that everybody's, or a lot of people are trying to work on, but there are constraints that I do understand. You know, it's not always the first thing that needs to be done. If the lift's broken down, money has to go on fixing a lift first before it goes on the smaller details of programming.
So one thing that you mentioned the British Museum are doing for young people with autism is the volunteer placements, which I think is, I've not heard of that happening elsewhere sort of as specifically targeted, but I think it's fantastic that you're doing that. How did that come about? How do you approach an initiative like providing volunteering placements for people with learning difficulties, people with learning disabilities, people with autism, or that kind of thing? How does that come about, and how does the process of putting that all together happen?
So I had experience in doing something similar, supported volunteering, from my previous work in charity. And then when I came to the museum, there had been a trial previously, which had been one person had come in, and we'd seen that it could work, but we wanted to set it up as more of an established program. So I work quite closely with the existing volunteering team and one particular volunteer coordinator, Jess Starnes. Her background is youth work and disability. And so between the two of us, we looked at actually, okay, what's probably the best approach to take? What curators and sort of departments would it work best in to start with? Which is why we focused on collections, because we can control the environment. It's away from the crowds because it's behind the scenes. So actually you're working in a curatorial collections department. And we basically worked out between ourselves what time we could give, how much support we could give, and got the curators trained up. And then it was a case of thinking about then an accessible applications process. So working with organisations to put people forward, trying to make it as an informal process as possible, but also trying to make sure that everything we do is about tailoring the placement to the person. So we look at what support they require, what reasonable adjustments we need to make, and what their interests are. And that's in our mind before they've even come for their interview. And then basically, yeah, it's a 6-week supported placement where they get to spend some time doing one particular task within a curatorial department, working with one particular curator. And then we also do tours, workshops, talks that relate to their interests. So the idea being really that it gives people an idea of different parts of the heritage sector and potential routes in. So it ties in quite nicely. We've had students who are doing university degrees that have come. We're currently working with somebody at the moment who's really interested in classical civilization. And yeah, sort of seeing how we can support them into potentially regular volunteering with us, and then potentially looking at how we can support them into a career. So two of our placementees and now regular volunteers on our hands-on desks in the collection. So hopefully it's sort of a pathway through rather than just being 6 weeks and then it stops.
That's really nice. And again, it's that sort of lifelong inclusion and not just including people for a little bit and then forgetting about them. That's really cool. If magically you could travel back through time, talk to your younger self and provide yourself with one piece of advice that you wish you'd had in your career, what would that be?
Not be afraid to take risks.
Okay.
So, you know, there was a moment where I nearly didn't leave the private sector.
Mm.
You know, I was really unsure, was it the right move to move to charity? And, you know, I've only been working for 6 years. I've already done three quite different careers.
Yeah.
But actually, it's getting me to where I want to be. It's interesting. I'm passionate about it. So I just think every opportunity you take or every decision you make will just lead you somewhere else. So don't sort of be worried too much about whether you're making the right or wrong decision, because I think fundamentally you'll end up where you're supposed to be.
If you had unlimited funding, what kind of museum would you create?
Ooh. So if I was building one from scratch?
Yeah, from scratch, from the ground up.
I would think about inclusive design from like day one. So the Welcome Collection, mm-hmm. of Justin, There Being Human exhibition. And obviously they did a lot around inclusive, accessible design. And I think it'd be really fantastic if a whole museum or art gallery was designed with that in mind. Yeah, I think that'd be really interesting to see. And then probably to have pieces and collections created, all, you know, curated and put together all by community groups or different groups, rather than sort of we bring people in, you know, to do certain trails or certain representations of the current collection. But actually, if you could start from scratch, just having everything curated by different groups would be fantastic.
I think there's probably a lot of people listening to this who are thinking what you're doing sounds, you know, really incredible and really inspiring. Have you got any practical advice for someone who is just, maybe they've just made that big career jump from an entirely different, entirely different sector, and they're now looking to work in museums? What kind of advice can you give them?
Ooh, I'd say probably that, you know, really focus on transferable skills. So actually you might be put off applying for something because you think, oh, I don't meet the exact job description. But I didn't have experience of working in the museum and arts sector before I applied for the British Museum role. And it was still my other experience that pulled me in, because actually they wanted somebody with, you know, specialisms on learning disabilities and autism, and that was my background. So I think don't be afraid to put yourself out there and go along and push yourself to try for interviews, because you never know what might happen.
So if you were a small museum and you wanted to make yourself more accessible with not so much funding, what tips would you give to them to do so?
Yeah, so I think one thing I'd say is things like the sensory map, because actually they can be online resources, so they can be produced in-house. So actually they can be something that's quite easy and low cost to do, but actually can make a huge difference in somebody being able to come and visit the museum or art gallery independently. And then I think the second thing is probably to focus on making small adjustments to maybe existing programmes. So if you do have a space nearby that you can create a pop-up sensory space. So we do that in the museum because we have a lack of space in the museum. So actually, because we have a lot of collections and we don't have somewhere we can have a permanent, dedicated, quiet area, we've bought sort of things that we can pop up and make sensory spaces. So things like teepees or tents, which you can then put blankets and cushions in. But that's quite a small thing that you can do, low cost, that actually can make an event accessible to somebody because they know they're somewhere safe and quiet they can go straight away. That would be my big tip, really, is think about just making small changes to your current programmes or events that actually could make a big difference to somebody.
Regarding sensory map, would you have a specialist create a sensory map or can anyone create it? What kind of things?
So the way we created ours was actually myself and a team from the museum, which was covering visitor services, other members of the learning team. So we actually did the groundwork ourselves and then we used the advisory panel. So we used the Families Autumn to then feed back, you know, like what icons would you like to use, what colours. So we actually did it quite minimal cost because actually it was predominantly done with the advisory panel and then myself and a team that already work there and then our design team. So I understand that not everyone has a design team, but actually that is something that you could pull together quite easily yourself. You don't have to kind of go externally, even though there are external organisations that you can go through, but you can do it internally and it still has the same results.
Is there anything you'd like to plug? Anything that you want to promote?
Go on the British Museum website and look on our accessible events, because over the next couple of months you're going to see a lot more events going up, so please watch out for them.
Beautiful. Holly, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Where can people find you?
To be honest, the easiest way to get in contact with me is probably to email the access@britishmuseum.org email, and then that's shared between me and my manager Fiona.
We hope you've enjoyed this week's episode of For Art's Sake. If you'd like to learn more about who we are and what we do, find us online at forartsake.co.uk, on Twitter @sake_arts, or on Instagram @forartsake.uk.